I want people to be able to see the screen there. And I'm wondering if we could dim the lights so that you actually see what's on the screen. Because I got a question for all of you. Do you know what you're looking at?
Looks like the surface of...
Neurons. Okay, what you're looking at is something called the cosmic web. That's the kind of the largest scale map of the universe that has been produced, although that's actually something that's been generated in a computer. And this was released just Friday night. And it's something astronomers have been waiting for literally for several years. And what they're releasing is something called the Big Bullseye. That's, I don't know why they called it that, but it's called the Big Bullseye Simulation of the Universe. But it's got another name too that I think is more appropriate. It's called the Multi-Dark Database. And it was released Friday night so that astronomers can start publishing all kinds of papers. It's kind of a replacement of what was called the Millennium Database, which was released in 2005. And what they did is they used a supercomputer back in 2005 to simulate the mass distribution of the universe and compare that mass distribution with actual observations of the distribution of galaxies and galaxy clusters that have been mapped by the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Now, that release back in 2005 led to the publication of over 400 research papers in different astronomical journals. But what has happened since 2005 is that we have a much more detailed map of the galaxies and galaxy clusters through the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Back in 2005, we had the first data release. We now have the seventh data release of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and it gives far more data than what people had available back in 2005. Yes?
What portion of the sky does this cover?
Well, I'm going to show you simulations at different resolution. This is kind of a large-scale thing, so you're looking at about 2 gigaparsecs of the sky, which translates to, from one end to the other, probably about 6.5 billion light years from one end of the slide to the other.
What angle is seen from the Earth?
Well, I mean, you can think of the universe as 14 billion years old, roughly. And so what we can see is looking back across 14 billion light years. That's as far back as you can look. So you're looking at a slice of the sky that's a little more than one-third of everything you can see. So, yeah. Well, it's kind of what astronomers do. They look back in time, and that's how you can see.
Is this every direction from the Earth?
No, okay. What physicists have done here is they take 10 billion point particles and put them in a computer and then simulate how those particles would behave according to different cosmic models. So basically what they do is they pump in different competing models of the universe and then calculate how that universe would unfold over the past 14 billion years, and then they compare that with actual observations that they get through the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. And the whole goal is to come up with as accurate a cosmic creation model as possible. So what was announced just Friday evening was a new release of the best simulation. And we're going to be able to compare that with the new Sloan Digital Sky Survey releases. And bottom line is, this is going to generate for us a far more accurate picture of the creation and history of the universe than we've had up to this time. Back in 2005, when astronomers first started to do this in a serious way, all we had was the first release of the WMAP satellite, because that's basically where these simulations pick up. They start when the universe is about 380,000 years old and bring you up to the present era. That's what they're simulating. You say, why did they start at 380,000 years and not sometime earlier or later? 380,000 years after the cosmic creation event is when you first get a distinction between bright spots and dimmer spots in the universe, or more massive concentrations and less massive concentrations, Or I could put it this way, it's the first moment in the history of the universe where light separates from darkness. Previous to that, it's just an even amorphous glow of light and energy. So there's really no interesting information if you go any earlier than that in terms of the dynamics of the universe. So they pick it up from there, then they run it forward. And so what you're looking at here are the distributions of galaxies and galaxy clusters. So you look on the slide, all the bright spots would be clusters of galaxies. And what you notice is that it appears that the universe has its galaxies distributed along filaments and webs. This is something that astronomers did not expect at all 30 years ago, but it's something that you would predict if the universe was dominated by exotic dark matter. And actually, this is the first time astronomers have been able to theoretically calculate where the little clumps of exotic dark matter should exist in the universe and how that would affect the formation, the dynamics, and the clustering of galaxies, and then compare that in detail with actual observations of clusters and galaxies. So this is a big deal to the astronomers, because now we have a tool that's far better than we had back in 2005, and it's actually based on more up-to-date data, because now we have the 7-year release of the WMAP cosmic background radiation as opposed to just 1 year's worth of data. And moreover, we have a satellite orbiting the Earth right now, the Planck satellite, which is going to give us an even more detailed map of the radiation vector from the cosmic creation event when the universe was only 380,000 years old. My guess is this will generate a minimum of 1,000 research papers in the astrophysical literature. And what I like about the people who generated this is that we're going to make it all public domain so that anybody can access the database. They made the software publicly available so anybody can manipulate the software and then begin comparing it in detail with actual observations. Yes?
Okay, where's the little arrow that says you are here?
Okay, we're not in this, Matt. But let me show you some. What I'm going to do is show you some broad scale maps, and then we're going to kind of zoom in so you can actually see what they've accomplished. So here's a different portion of the sky where they've done this kind of simulation. And if you don't like the orange colors and the black, they've done one where you can, kind of like a blue-black background, but all the bright orange spots you see there would be clusters of galaxies, and the tiny dots would be individual galaxies. Yes?
Is this, what this is telling us is that we're all the matter in the universe is sort of clustered along filaments.
It's clustered along filaments and webs with huge voids of virtual nothing in between. So this is a very high-resolution map of the simulation of the distributions of galaxies. Now keep in mind, this is all theoretical. This isn't actual. But what they do is they take this theory, then compare it with the observations and see how good of a fit they get. And if they don't get a good fit, then they know that the model they've developed is based on incorrect cosmological assumptions. But what you see here is the map that you get if you assume what's called the lambda cold dark matter model of the universe. And if you're not familiar with that term, lambda means that the universe is dominated by dark energy. And you know, we have measurements that show us that dark energy makes up about 72% of all the stuff of the universe. It's the energy that's embedded in the space surface of the universe that results in the universe expanding more and more rapidly as that space surface gets bigger and bigger. And then the cold dark matter is the idea that the universe has 6 times as much exotic dark matter as it does ordinary dark matter. You say, what's the difference? And then the cold dark matter is the idea that the universe has 6 times as much exotic dark matter as it does ordinary dark matter. You say, what's the difference? Exotic dark matter. Well, let me tell you what ordinary dark matter is. Ordinary dark matter is the stuff that all your bodies are made of, our Earth is made of, the Sun is made of, our galaxy is made of. Basically, neutrons, protons, and electrons. That's ordinary matter. It has the property that it strongly interacts with photons. And so if you've got protons, neutrons, and electrons, and there's photons in the vicinity, you're going to get a strong reaction, which is why if you get a big enough clump of protons, neutrons, and electrons, it becomes a star, because of how efficiently it interacts with the photons. Exotic dark matter is the opposite. It's matter that does not interact with photons, or it's matter that interacts with photons at an extremely weak level. Because it is at an extremely weak level, at least for some of these exotic mass particles, we can actually detect them. But you know what they have to do is they go down deep into a mine, say a mile or so underground, and then they get a huge body of water, 10 to 20,000 gallons of water, and they ring it with photometers, hoping to catch a stray photon that all this exotic dark matter would be interacting with. But there's actually exotic dark matter particles that don't interact with photons at all, and the only way you can detect them is through the gravitational effect. Now, we are able to detect them because the stuff is six times as abundant as the ordinary dark matter. And moreover, what our observations are telling us, the exotic dark matter clumps, and because it clumps efficiently, we can detect its gravitational influence. And when we say cold exotic dark matter, we're meaning that the exotic dark matter particles are moving at low velocities rather than high velocities. If they're moving at relativistic velocities, that is velocities close to the velocity of light, we call it hot dark matter. We call it cold dark matter if it moves at low velocities, close to zero, or if it's in between, we call it warm dark matter. And what these simulations are telling us, when we compare them with actual observations, is that indeed what's called the lambda cold dark matter is right. If we slightly adjust the model where the exotic dark matter is predominantly cold with a little tad of warm. So a little bit of warm, but mostly cold, exotic dark matter, where the exotic stuff is six times as abundant as the ordinary stuff, where most of the ordinary stuff is dark rather than glowing with light, and where it's complemented by three times as much dark energy as everything else combined. So, and what they announced just Friday evening is that thanks to this simulation, they get a far better fit and a far stronger confirmation of the lambda cold dark matter hot Big Bang creation model than they've ever had before. Mainly that the older simulations that we had underpredicted the clumping of the exotic dark matter. And now that they've got better data and better computers, they're using a much bigger supercomputer. After all, it takes a big computer to simulate the movements of 10 billion independent particles, as you can imagine. And they actually run these supercomputers for like an entire month where it does nothing but work out the calculations. But yeah, the bottom line is just with this initial announcement, they've already done some preliminary analysis on this that shows that this model predicts about up to 50% greater clumping density than the previous models predicted, and that's exactly what we need to get a perfect fit with the observational results. So this is being announced as a significant step in proving that indeed the correct model for the creation of the universe is a hot Big Bang inflationary universe dominated by dark energy, where the matter makes up about 27% of all the stuff of the universe, and 5/6 of that stuff is exotic dark matter, where almost all of that exotic dark matter is moving at a slow velocity. And you say, what's the whole point of all this theologically? The more detailed a cosmic creation model we can get, the more confident we can be that what the Bible has always predicted about the universe indeed is accurate. The Bible is on record as being the only book that taught Big Bang cosmology until the 20th century. So literally for thousands of years, the Bible stood alone in saying that the universe is a beginning of matter, energy, space, and time, where the universe continuously expands from an infinitesimal volume under constant laws of physics, where one of those laws is a pervasive law of decay, which would predict that the universe would get colder and colder as it gets older and older by a highly predictable amount that we can actually confirm with direct measurements. In fact, I actually presented that to the Orange County Astronomical Society a couple of weeks ago, saying, you know, here's the biblical predicted cooling curve for the universe, and here are the actual measurements, and you can see how beautifully it fits. I'll take a couple of questions before I actually zoom in on this, and you can actually see what they've done. Yeah, Ted, you're first.
What's the wavelength of the WMAP sensors?
Well, we're now measuring the radiation from the cosmic creation event literally at dozens of different wavelengths. But the WMAP was a satellite put in orbit above the Earth that was designed to pick up the wavelengths where that radiation is most predominant, which is short millimeter wavelengths. And those are very difficult measurements to make from the ground because the atmosphere of the Earth just messes up any observations, because that's where water is really predominant. That explains, too, why the ground-based measurements of the cosmic background radiation, where they're trying to pick up those specific wavelengths, where the cosmic background radiation really stands out, are all done in Antarctica. You need a place that's extremely cold, because the colder the atmosphere, the more the water that drops out of the atmosphere, and therefore the clearer the observations you get. That's also true if you go to high elevations. So the two places in the world where they're doing these measurements from the ground as opposed to a satellite, there's a plateau in Chile that's at 17,000 feet elevation. It's a place in Chile where it never rains. I mean, it literally never rains. The measured rainfall on a per annum basis is 0.01 inches. That's how much rain they get per year. I mean, if you go up there, there's not a green thing on the ground. It really looks like the surface of Mars, because there's nothing living there because it's just so incredibly dry. But being that dry and at that elevation, it's a beautiful place to do these kinds of observations. The other trick is to go to a place where it's 100 below zero all the time, because that will freeze out the water. And they've actually found a site in Antarctica that they think will be almost as good as being in outer space, which is going to save you taxpayers a ton of money. And it's a place on a ridge in not at the South Pole, but between the South Pole and the South Ocean. It's just under 14,000 feet, so it's nice high elevation. And it's in the interior. And what really excites astronomers, it's a place where there's no wind. We don't like wind, because wind moves our telescope. So you want a place where there's no wind, so you've got nice, steady pointing. And you also want a place where the temperature never changes. That's one of the things that bothers me when I pull my telescope out of my living room and put it in the backyard. The temperature changes so dramatically that the images are all blurry until after a few hours go by. And actually, what I really need to do is take the telescope up in some mountain, because after all, the temperature in your backyard varies over the course of the night. It's not a good situation. You know, people look through my telescope and say, how come the image is so blurry? And I said, well, the temperature's changing. But we found a place in Antarctica where the temperature doesn't change by more than 2 degrees Fahrenheit over the entire year, day and night. Day and night temperature is the same. Summer and winter temperature the same, doesn't change. While the temperature variation goes between 94 below zero and 96 below zero throughout the entire year, day and night. And so that's got astronomers really excited, because they say, hey, we finally found one place on Earth where there's no wind, no temperature change, very cold, and high altitude. So they're all signing up to go there. Well, not really. But the whole idea is going to be a lot cheaper to build something there than to try to put it in outer space. So that's a place where we're going to, again, be able to do more detailed comparisons than we can do even now. So that will be happening. And you're next, and I'm coming back to you. Go ahead.
The universe still is expanding, right?
Yes.
It's not contracting.
It's still expanding. Moreover, it's expanding faster and faster as every year goes by.
Now, what's the shape of the universe, basically?
Well, it's roughly 10-dimensionally flat. And don't try to visualize it. Can't be done.
10-dimensionally flat.
Yeah.
Well, when it's expanding...
No, that's roughly, okay?
If it's here, then then what's here? Nothing? And then it just it creates its own space?
Okay. All the stuff of the universe is constrained to the surface of the universe. There's nothing interior to the surface, and there's nothing exterior to the surface. And I mean nothing. I mean there's a total lack of matter, energy, space dimensions, and time. So there's no time and no space interior to the surface or exterior to the surface. We're all constrained to the surface, but the surface gets bigger every year that goes by. And so people say, well, you know, what's out there? Well, if we wait long enough, we'll be there, because the universe will expand to that point. But we'll only be there for a moment, because we'll continue expanding. So nothing beyond, nothing interior. It's all on the surface.
Oh, I see. So.
No, you really don't see. Nobody can visualize it. We can prove it's true, but you can't visualize it.
Is there an advantage
to not being able to visualize it?
No, to the flat, the way you're explaining it.
Well, the flatness of the universe, or at least the approximate flatness of the universe, explains the inflationary event. The inflationary event would predict that the universe's geometry would be extremely close to flat. And the inflationary episode takes place when the strong nuclear force separates out from the electroweak force. Because as the universe is expanding from the cosmic creation event, it's getting colder and colder. And with that, you get the single force of the universe that it had at the beginning that separates into first two forces, three forces, and finally four forces. So, but when you get the separation of the strong nuclear force from the electroweak force, that's the second separation of the forces, that's when the universe hyperinflates. And so when you get what's called symmetry breaking, where you're getting the separation of the forces, weird things can happen physically. And if you want a more prosaic example that you're all familiar with, consider a bar magnet. If you heat the bar magnet up to about 500 degrees centigrade or about 900 degrees Fahrenheit, you'll notice the magnetism disappears. Well, it doesn't really disappear. What happens is the magnetic energy and the heat energy blend together and become one. And when the bar magnet cools, the two forces separate. Well, the same principle happens to the universe. And so the first force to come out is gravity. And so when the universe is 10 to the minus 43 seconds old, you have not just one force, but two forces, gravity and the strong electroweak. And then when the universe is about 10 to the minus 34 seconds old, you have gravity, the strong nuclear force, and the electroweak force. And when the universe is roughly a millionth of a trillionth of a second old, that's when electromagnetism separates out from the weak nuclear force. Now, we can actually prove that this is true for the last separation of the forces, because we've got particle accelerators that today are powerful enough to duplicate the temperature density of the universe when it was a millionth of a trillionth of a second old. And so we can actually see in particle accelerators electromagnetism and the weak nuclear force blending together and then separating apart. We can actually do experiments where we can study that in some detail. And part of the motivation for spending a few billion of your tax dollars was to work with the Europeans and the Russians and the Chinese and a few other people to build the Large Hadron Collider, a $10 billion instrument. And part of the motivation for that big particle accelerator is to try to dig a little bit deeper and see if we can actually perform experiments that will teach us something about the separation of the strong nuclear force from the electroweak force. And that actually has cosmological implications, because establishing that means that the universe really did have this period of hyperinflation. Now, before 10 to the minus 34 seconds, the universe was about the diameter of an electron. And by the time it got through the inflationary episode, it became the size of a grapefruit. But all that happened in about 10 to the minus 34 seconds, which means you got the universe expanding far faster, orders of magnitude faster, thousands of times faster than the velocity of light. And it's that that makes the universe flat. That's what flattens out the geometry of the universe. And that's actually what makes the universe thermally connected. And if that event hadn't happened, the universe would not be thermally connected, and your life depends on the universe being thermally connected. So when you celebrate Thanksgiving next month, you want to thank God for that inflationary episode, which made everything thermally connected so that you can enjoy your Thanksgiving dinner. So now you know what Thanksgiving is like at our house. So, although my sons aren't too terribly tolerant of it, but I do my best. Now there's another, you had a hand up. Go ahead.
Could what you're displaying possibly have any bearing on the multiverse in any way, because in disproving, if you can, the multiverse theory?
The multiverse theories, and there are several of them, cannot be proven, but they can be disproven. The reason we can't prove them is that if you have observers in one universe, and if God made a second universe, once you've got observers existing, the space-time envelope of that universe cannot overlap the space-time envelope of any other existing universe, which means it will always be impossible for us as observers to prove the existence of another universe. If God made 10,000, we will not know because of our constraints in space and time. On the other hand, it is possible to disprove the multiverse in the sense that all multiverse models demand that the universe would have an open geometry. And that's one of the motivations. We're trying to measure the geometry of the universe as accurately as possible. And our measurements tell us it's approximately flat. But we're trying to measure the geometry as accurately as possible because the evidence shows that it's either slightly closed or flat, but it doesn't appear to be open. And if we can really nail that down with high precision, we can rule out these multiverse models. Now, if we'd be ruling out physical multiverse models, we're not ruling out spiritual multiverse models. Because after all, the biblical text tells us that God made a realm separate from ours where he houses the angels. And we have heaven and hell. So I've always told people who are trying to espouse the multiverse that first of all, you need to realize this is originally a Christian doctrine, that God made more than one realm, and he's making another one called the new creation. And so this is not something that is an atheistic speculation, but atheists are speculating that there's an infinite number of universes, and ours by pure chance has the characteristics that make life possible. And I've commented in my books, that's the only place you can go as an atheist if you're faced with overwhelming evidence for exquisite design for the benefit of human beings, where that design is all in place before we human beings even show up. So it's not at all surprising that atheists are going there. Where else are they going to go? But the timing is not a coincidence. They only proposed this when the evidence became overwhelming that the universe has been designed for the specific benefit of human beings. And moreover, it's inconsistent with the rest of science, because if you're really going to say that there's an infinite number of universes with an infinite variety of characteristics being represented, then you could argue that everything we human beings is a product of pure chance, not of intellect. And I don't know of any scientist writing papers on the multiverse that actually believes that. So it runs into a logical fallacy, because then you're really saying that there's no meaning to anything we human beings ever produce.
Define closed versus open.
Closed versus open. A closed geometry would be kind of like the geometry of the Earth, where if you start on the Earth and move along the surface, you'll come back to where you started. So it would either be spherical or egg-shaped or something like that. Whereas an open universe means something equivalent to, say, like a parabola, where you'd be walking along the surface of the parabola, and if you keep walking one direction, you'll never come back to where you started. It's going to go off into infinity. So that's open, but and then flat is where it's flat. Okay. But what makes this all difficult is we're talking 10 dimensions, 9 dimensions of space, and 1 dimension of time. Yeah, in the back, and then I want to zoom in for you. Go ahead.
Kind of off, Alex is kind of not very bright, but when you said we're expanding and there's nothing like, I always thought that, you know, it seems like that what's in between is the dark matter, but that's just nothing. So there's nothing and dark matter?
Oh, no, I'm not saying that, because what we're looking at here is a map of the surface of the universe. And yeah, there's stuff all over that surface. Dark energy exists all over that surface. But in portions of that surface, you'll see concentrations of exotic dark matter and ordinary dark matter. And then you'll see places where the concentrations are so great that it actually produces stars and you see light. So that's what you're looking at here. So even in those dark spots of this map, stuff is there, just not as much stuff as there is along the filaments. I mean, what this is telling us is that the universe is filamentous in its characteristics, in the sense that most of the stuff is along the filaments, and in between there's not much stuff there at all. But it would be wrong to refer to those voids there as being totally empty. No, that's not the case. There's matter, energy, space, and time there, just not a lot of matter. So, okay, let's zoom in on this a little bit. And maybe you can catch this here. We're picking up that spot in the center there, roughly this spot here, and kind of zooming in on what we can see. And so here we're zooming in on that particular little spot there, and that bright spot there is a cluster of galaxies. And you can see that the... you can't see as much as you can see in my computer, because actually when you zoom in here, there are filaments that are running all the way through this. They're just fainter than the brighter filaments. So you've got bright filaments, and then you have substructure in here, so it's literally loaded with filaments going everywhere. And maybe the next slide will actually pick some of that up for you. Let's see. Yeah, you can see a little bit of the subfilaments. So you got the big subfilaments, the subfilaments, and subfilaments of the subfilaments. But what you can see there is we're zooming in on a cluster of galaxies there at the center. And what you notice is that the cross points of the filaments, you always get supergiant galaxies. So here we are zooming in a little closer, and the bright spots are big galaxies, and you can all see kinds of little things all around there. And here we're zooming in a little closer again, and you can see a double galaxy over on the left, and then lots of small stuff in between. And here we're zooming in on a single galaxy. And what you're actually looking at here, don't think of this as so much as stars. The bright spots here are showing you clumps of matter. So this may not have any stars or very few stars in it at all, but it is a dense concentration of mostly exotic dark matter. But that would be a galaxy where it actually has stars. And so what this is telling us, for example, is that surrounding our Milky Way galaxy would be literally hundreds of clumps of dark matter that are not emitting any light, but they are affecting the dynamics of our galaxy and actually play a role in stabilizing the spiral structure of our galaxy so that life would be possible. So yeah, again, when you celebrate Thanksgiving, you want to thank God for all those little clumps of exotic dark matter that are surrounding our galaxy and other galaxies that actually make advanced life possible. So this is giving us some insight that we should expect to find literally hundreds of dense clumps of exotic dark matter surrounding our galaxy and other galaxies. And actually, if you read the astronomical literature, we're beginning to discover those clumps of exotic dark matter. We're discovering them because they will produce a few stars, not many, but a few small stars. As we pick that up and look at the gravity that that particular clump is exerting around it, we can tell there must be a large mass of exotic dark matter there. And moreover, I think astronomers are on the verge of actually detecting particles in these clumps, because what we're now learning is that these little spots of exotic dark matter, the denser ones, are places where we should be able to observe the decay of these exotic dark matter particles and actually detect what kinds of particles that are there, the density, and is going to give us a much more detailed cosmic creation model than we have now. I wrote a series of 5 articles on this for today's New Reasons to Believe that you can check out, and I think within a year or two, they're going to have the actual detections of sterile neutrinos and axions. And then that's going to give us a lot more insight that, again, we can compare with these detailed computer simulations. But the bottom line is, thanks to what was released on Friday, we can now have greater confidence in the biblically predicted hot Big Bang creation model that the Bible has taught for thousands of years. Yes, we can turn the lights on.
This is somewhat related, and if you don't mind, and if it's not related enough, please let me know. But we were watching, Nancy and I were watching the Discovery thing of Stephen Hawking's universe.
Mm-hmm.
He said that, you know, the hype says that, well, we've got gravity, so we don't need God. But as I was watching it, that's not what he said. He said gravity was created in the Big Bang.
Right.
So he's leaving the whole subject of creation aside. And all he's saying is that gravity coalesced what was already there.
Right.
And that's not a big story.
Well, that's why I think it's probably not accurate to label Stephen Hawking an atheist. Because he is saying that there must be some causal agent out there that produces the mathematics, that produces the laws of physics, generates gravity, the four fundamental forces of physics. His comment is, once that's all in place, once God does all that setting up, God can take a 14 billion year vacation, and the gravity can do everything else after that. Hawking's theology is strongly arguing against the personal God. I think he's okay with the idea that there's a God out there that sets up the math and the physics, brings the universe into existence, but he really doesn't want that God having anything to do with his life or his personal being. So, which is not unusual for scientists to want to be autonomous in terms of their lives.
It's unfortunate the hype misses the mark.
Well, if you want to hear a response to that, Jeff Swearing, Dave Rogstad, and myself, moderated by Ken Samples, our staff philosopher, we did three podcasts on that televised show. So it runs for about an hour. It's about basically three 40-minute shows we did responding to that, bringing out what Hawking believes, what he doesn't believe, and also putting into context the comments, because they interviewed quite an interesting spectrum of people on Hawking's ideas that ran the gamut from Christian all the way to atheist. But it was interesting what they were all saying in common. And our whole point in doing the podcast is, you know, the biblical cosmic creation model is on a much stronger foundation than what PBS indicates. If you simply look at where they agree, what they're stating, we Christians have a lot to be encouraged by this new research. But also making the point that the argument that God is not personal is not based on gravity or cosmology. It's based on Hawking's presumption that origin of life researchers have solved the origin of life problem and have explained how living entities can come from non-living entities, which is simply not true. The truth of the matter is origin of life researchers have found themselves up against a wall. And that wall is getting more challenging for them with every month that goes by.
As John Lennox points out, there's a philosophical assumption, assertion.
Right. Well, there's a second assumption Hawking makes. One, he makes the statement that origin of life has been solved from a naturalistic perspective, which is flat out wrong. And that's admitted by atheist origin of life researchers. The other thing that was flat out wrong was a statement that the discovery of hundreds of planets outside of our solar system proved that there's nothing unusual about our solar system planets or the Earth. And that statement, again, is flat out wrong. And those are the two big data points that he appealed to argue we don't need a personal God. And his whole point is if we don't need a personal God to explain the origin of life, and if we don't need a personal God to explain the characteristics of our planets, then we probably don't need him to explain the characteristics of the universe. That's kind of a summary of his book, The Grand Design. By the way, his co-author, Molybdenum, is an atheist. And so it's hard to tell whose theology is coming through the different chapters that you see in The Grand Design. Because I see a little bit of flip-flop as I go from chapter to chapter, and I kind of wish that each of these two gentlemen would put their name, because I got the idea that Molybdenum is probably responsible for the earlier chapters and that Hawking was responsible for the later chapters, but I don't know. It would have been nice to know who wrote what. or whether they did it in collaboration. Over here.
If exotic dark matter is subject to gravity, what prevents it from mixing with ordinary dark matter? Why is there no exotic dark matter on Earth, for example?
Well, exotic dark matter is six times as abundant as ordinary dark matter. So where exotic dark matter clumps, it's going to draw ordinary dark matter into it. However, it clumps differently than exotic dark matter. So ordinary dark matter is able to come together much more efficiently than exotic dark matter. So that explains, for example, why the stuff you see in a galaxy tends to be in a relatively concentrated volume. And surrounding that is a big halo of ordinary dark matter, typically 5 to 10 times bigger in size than the stuff that we see through the telescope. And surrounding that is an even bigger halo of exotic dark matter. And that's kind of what these simulations are trying to do, is to determine the dynamics of exotic dark matter and ordinary dark matter. A lot of it has to do with what particles you put into it. A lot of it has to do with the expansion history of the universe. And then, you know, what actually gives you the best fit with actual observations of the galaxies we see. So basically it's a partnership between the Sloan Digital Sky Survey, cosmic background radiation maps, and computer simulations of the dynamics of the history of the universe. So that's really what's going on in this study.
Well, what keeps them from mixing? Is there some simultaneous repulsive force between exotic dark matter and ordinary dark matter that keeps them separate?
Well, there is exotic dark matter going through your body. But the problem is exotic dark matter does not interact. Actually, it's not a problem. It's a blessing. The exotic dark matter does not interact with the photons. And so when a neutrino passes through your body, it goes right through your body without interacting with anything, which means nothing gets damaged. That's a good thing. Whereas in a cosmic ray that goes through your body, like say a fast-moving electron zips through your body, or worse yet, a fast-moving uranium nuclei goes through your body, because it interacts with photons, it will typically do considerable damage as it goes through your body. So, yeah, I'm not saying there are no exotic matter particles around here. It's just that because of their characteristics, we really don't notice them. And in order to notice them, we have to build very sophisticated detectors to pick them up. I mean, to give you an example, when a supernova explodes, it pours out huge bursts of neutrinos, which are these exotic mass particles. I mean, copious amounts. It's kind of the predominant effect of a supernova eruption. And yet, when the supernova exploded in the Large Magellanic Cloud in 1987, which ranks as the closest supernova that's been available to astronomers where they could actually detect the neutrinos. The only neutrinos they found, six. Just six was all they were able to detect, even though we're looking at quadrillions of neutrinos heading towards the Earth from that supernova eruption. Because of how weakly they interact with light, we could only detect six. Now, there's a blessing in that, too. One that did strongly interact with matter, that means every time a supernova explodes, we'd be wiped off the face of the Earth. So I'm kind of glad that the exotic mass particles behave the way they do. Yes?
Are neutrinos coming now from the Sun?
Yes.
Well, how do they distinguish between the neutrinos from that eruption and from the Sun?
Well, because they were getting these six neutrinos coming from a little tiny patch in the sky, and it coincided with the position of the supernova eruption. Moreover, the neutrinos arrived at the same time that the first photons came out of the supernova eruption. So it was the timing and the geography that convinced them these really were coming from the supernova. And by the way, the burst was over in a split second. So you got the neutrinos and then nothing.
So if they're way underground, with a big tank of water to collect these neutrinos, how do they know where they came from in the sky when they're way down there?
Well, that is a problem. So timing was the real issue. So, because yeah, I mean, you can detect solar neutrinos when the sun is on the opposite side of the Earth, and neutrinos just go right through the Earth. And the reason why they go deep underground, they're trying to get rid of the cosmic rays.
because the signal from the cosmic rays totally overwhelms the signal you get from the neutrinos. So unless you go a mile underground or more, you're not going to detect the neutrinos. They'll be wiped out in the noise of cosmic ray detection. So that's why they measure them the way you do. Yeah, I mean, there's really only one supernova rupture where we've been able to detect the neutrinos. I mean, people have been asking me, what about this supernova that just erupted in Messier 101? It's 23 million light years away. That's too far away for us to have any hope of picking up the neutrinos. The one that erupted in 1987 was only 166,000 light years away. Still pretty far away, but close enough that we could pick up a few neutrinos. Now, if Sirius were to go supernova tomorrow, we'd have no problem finding the neutrinos. On the other hand, none of the astronomers would survive the event. So, let's not wish for that. But I mean, I'll tell you this, Sirius will go supernova, but probably not anytime soon. So, okay, any more before we move on? Let me get back to our, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, you say that the exotic dark matter and the ordinary dark matter clump differently.
Yes.
I mean, clumping is caused by gravity.
Yes.
So do they obey different gravitational laws?
Well, the thing about ordinary matter is it strongly interacts with electromagnetism. So that has an impact. Whereas with exotic dark matter, that's not the case. And they decay differently, too. You know, neutrons will decay into protons, but the exotic dark matter particles also have different decay characteristics. That's one of the values of these maps, of trying to learn a little bit more about the dynamics of these different forms of exotic dark matter. In fact, there are astronomers who are saying if we get good enough simulations to compare with detailed distributions of galaxies, maybe we can even figure out what kinds of particles are responsible, or the predominant particles are responsible for the exotic dark matter clumps. So, and by the way, if you've got a big clump of ordinary dark matter, it will draw in some exotic dark matter halos. Our galaxy is eating exotic dark matter, so it's being fed into the center of our galaxy and being distributed out. That is happening, but because exotic dark matter is so dispersed in the history of the universe, it takes considerable time for that to happen. I mean, for example, there's
dispersed on the surface.
Well, okay. Kind of what's going on in the history of the universe is the exotic dark matter halos will behave differently than the ordinary dark matter halos. Because when ordinary matter clumps, you get stars. And if you get a big star, it's going to go supernova, and it's going to blow stuff out. That's not going to happen with exotic dark matter, but it will happen with ordinary dark matter. It blows stuff out, and then it coalesces back in again. And so that's why they needed these supercomputers, is trying to map in detail the dynamical history of ordinary matter and exotic dark matter, taking into account what happens when it interacts with light and what the light does to the dynamics of the ordinary matter. So, it's complicated. And that's what these computer simulations are trying to do for us. But what's interesting is they actually predict that there will be these filamentary structures. And you won't get those filamentary structures unless you have the kind of dynamics of exotic dark matter that we believe is correct. Yeah, Tim.
Does the dark matter ever coalesce into black holes?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, black hole will absorb neutrinos. No problem with that. As long as it gets close enough. So,
you think perhaps the major amount of mass in a black hole is this exotic dark matter?
That's something astronomers are still working out. I mean, again, because the fact that ordinary matter interacts strongly with electromagnetic radiation, it's going to be easier for a black hole to suck in ordinary matter than exotic dark matter. When the exotic dark matter gets close enough, it will get sucked in. So, and then what happens thereafter is still a big mystery. So, yes.
I just real quickly, you had mentioned before about universes. Is that the same as parallel universes?
Yeah, roughly. Yeah, saying that there are other universes out there where things are different.
Okay, I just wanted to call something.
Yeah. I mean, keep in mind when people say, yeah, maybe we've got an infinite number of universes where we're all the same. In which case, I mean, how do you explain our characteristics by pure chance? Yeah, we get 10 minutes at the end, so I'm going to jump into this. And I promise I would cover this whole subject of, we're talking about human origins, Psalm 139. And the whole idea I want to bring up here is the fact that we live in a 14 billion year universe, but the universe, because of its physics, provides only a narrow time window in which human beings can exist. So I kind of want to explore that. But let me just show you what that time window is like. So we're going to take 13.75 billion years and compress that down to 24 hours. Then ask the question, if each one of us, I'm with that gift, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen. And the whole idea I want to bring up here is the fact that we live in a 14 billion year universe, but the universe, because of its physics, provides only a narrow time window in which human beings can exist. So I kind of want to explore that. But let me just show you what that time window is like. So we're going to take 13.75 billion years and compress that down to 24 hours. Then ask the question, what is the human era? The human era, literally, is the last 0.3 seconds of the history of the universe. So, a lot was going on before we showed up. And you really can't make that 0.3 seconds any bigger than what it is. Now, people have the idea, well, maybe we can exist here for another billion years. That's not the case. The universe is old. We human beings are very recent upon the scene, and we can't be on the scene for much longer. So if your hope is in the universe, I got bad news for you. Okay, this was discovered back in the mid-1980s, and was discovered by the British cosmologist Brandon Carter. I believe he's a theist, but not a Christian, but I'm not certain. He just hasn't been that forthcoming about what he really believes theologically. On the other hand, he was the one who first talked about what's called the anthropic principle inequality. Now, I think you've all heard of the anthropic principle. I mean, if you watch PBS or Discovery or read any books about the universe, that term goes out everywhere. And it's the observation by astronomers that the universe has hundreds of characteristics that must be exquisitely fine-tuned to make possible the existence of human beings. However, there's been a couple of papers published recently making the point that really, the anthropic principle that was proposed 50 years ago has kind of degraded into the prebiotic principle. And I think there's a lot of validity for that as I read what astronomers write about the anthropic principle. Instead of looking at what's necessary in order to have a universe that would allow the existence of human beings, they're now defining the anthropic principle as what kind of fine-tuning you need to get the elements that would make possible life chemistry. So that's why a number of astronomers have said, hey, you know, you've got to stop calling it the anthropic principle, because the way all you astronomers are using the term, it's simply what you need to get free body chemistry. Not what you need to get life, just what you need to get free body chemistry. And that's significant because the fine-tuning you need for the equivalent of human beings is many, many hundreds of orders of magnitude greater than what you need to get free body chemistry, or even what you need to have a universe that can support a bacterium. In fact, you'll see that in our website. If you go to reasons.org/fine-tuning, you'll see a database there where we separate out the fine-tuning you need to get a planet that supports bacteria for 90 days or less, compared with what you need to get a planet that will support bacteria for 3 billion years or more, compared to what you need to get a planet that would support the equivalent of trilobites, compared to what you need to get a planet that would support the equivalent of human beings. And the value of that database is it just shows you, as you move up in complexity of life, the fine-tuning demand is orders of magnitude greater and greater. But it is such that Paul Davies, the agnostic, has said in his book, The Cosmic Blueprint, when you look at what's necessary to design the universe or to fine-tune the universe to get the equivalent of human beings, He says the evidence for design is overwhelming. He doesn't speculate on who the designer is, but he says the design is utterly overwhelming. And then you have Freeman Dyson, who's either an agnostic or an atheist physicist, who says, when you look at the universe, there's no way to avoid the conclusion that somehow the universe knew that we human beings were coming. In other words, it was designed in advance for the appearance of human beings. But it was Brandon Carter who noted that given the laws of physics we see in the universe, it's impossible to bring human beings or the functional equivalent of human beings on the cosmic scene in anything less than approximately 14 billion years. You can get bacteria here after about 10.5 billion years, but you're not going to get human beings or the equivalent of human beings or even things like porpoises or elephants. That's kind of the minimum time you need to prepare a home for human beings. He does speculate that maybe he can do it with more time, but he says there's no way he can do it in less time than that. That's the minimum time to prepare the universe for the entry of the equivalent of human life. Then he looks at those same laws of physics and characteristics of the universe and says that it's not possible for human beings or the functional equivalent to live in a civilized state for any longer than 41,000 years. And that's the upper limit of how long humans can live in a civilized state.
Where are we now?
Are you concerned? All right. Longer should be concerned.
On the head.
Now, humans have been here somewhere between 50 and 90,000 years, but Brandon Carter was not looking at how long human beings can exist in the universe, but how long they can exist in a civilized state. And what he meant by civilized state is something on the level of the Neolithic Revolution or greater. The Neolithic Revolution occurred 11,000 years ago, and that's defined as the first moment in human history when human beings were living in villages and towns where they had transportation corridors, where they were specializing in their activities and trading with one another. So that's kind of what's considered to be civilization. So you have a village, for example, that would specialize in making pottery. Another village would specialize in making clothing. Another one would specialize on, say, having farms of grain, and one with, say, animal husbandry, and then they'd be trading products with one another. That's been going on a measurable level. I'm not saying that wasn't going on before, but in terms of a measurable level, only for the last 11,000 years. Previous to that, you may have had families engaged in all those activities, where the son would take care of the animals, another son would take care of the grain. You kind of see that with Adam and Eve and Cain and Abel, that they were specializing, but they were specializing as individuals. They weren't specializing as villages and towns with transportation systems.
Was that Neolithic?
That's called the Neolithic Revolution. That took place 11,000 years ago. So to answer your question, we got 30,000 years left before.
So I can put off today or tomorrow record. I can relax.
Well, that 41,000 year figure is being debated. I've talked about this here in the class. I mean, we have reasons to believe, think a more reasonable estimate is 20,000 years, which means you only got 9,000 years left. So, and then if you're talking about a higher level of civilization, that brings the time down. And clearly we're at a much higher level of civilization today than we were 11,000 years ago. So the greater the technology, the greater the wealth, the faster you've got to give that up. Now, I'm not saying it means the extinction of the human species, but it does mean the extinction of civilization as we know.
When do you think we hit that, the actual intellectual peak, the actual...
Well, that's an interesting debate. I actually have friends who claim that we're a little bit past that peak, and that from now on we're going to be looking at lower standards of living rather than higher standards of living. And it's just because of the consequences of technology and wealth on human health, and human well-being and productivity. And so we may be at the peak or close to the peak, and then we're going to see things. That's the way you solve this problem. You want to hang around a little longer than 9,000 years, all you need to do is go back to the Stone Age technology. And you can probably persist for a little bit longer, but only a little bit longer. There's actually some hard limits to the existence of human beings at any level of civilization.
Well, I would say you're the peak. There's nothing smarter than you.
I think Jesus was maybe the smartest kid. I mean, they were smart a long time ago.
Well, there's actually studies that indicate that our IQ is going down century by century, average IQ of the human species. So you've got a good point. In the days of the Romans, individuals may have been a lot smarter than we are. I think what's different about modern day society, we're able to ferret out those few individuals that are kind of at one end or the other, and then they put them appropriate to use. So we're able to specialize more than we were in the days of Romans. But yeah, there are people arguing that the intellect of the human species is actually on the downside now, not going on the upside. Now that's in spite of the fact that IQ scores are going up, but the problem is people learning how to study for those IQ scores, and we're educating people in such a way. And let's face it, IQ tests really don't measure brilliance. They're measuring just performance, and so people can train for this. But that's all a big debate. But yeah, I mean, you'd expect that at some point they're going to hit a decline. And so there's a big debate going on whether we're on the decline side or we've still got a few more years where things can get better. We'll see. Never mind taking into account sin. All right. It looks like I'm out of time. But what I want to do next week when we get together, although I'm not sure I'm going to be here next week. I think, yeah, I'm back in Buffalo, New York. So a couple of weeks from today, I'll be back. And we're going to actually give the physical explanation behind this inequality and why probably the inequality is more extreme than we see here. But what I want to tell you is Brandon Carter was the first physicist to recognize the philosophical implications of this inequality. Namely, look at what has to be invested to make human beings possible and how short of a time we can exist in that state. And he was the one that concluded there's got to be someone out there that has a very high value and a very high purpose for the human species. How else can we explain this incredible inequality? And keep in mind, we're looking at a factor of a million between those two numbers. So it takes a million times more time to prepare a home for us than the time which we can live in that home. That'd be like your father building a house for you, where it takes a million years to build a house, but you only live in it for 1 year. I mean, so you can think about that between now and a couple of weeks ago we did together, but we're going to actually look at several reasons why this inequality must be the way it is. And actually what we're looking at is a powerful new argument for design, in that we're going to see a number of narrow time windows that must be met for human beings to exist, and they all line up at the same time. And there's really nothing in the physics that would demand that they all line up at the same time, but they do. And the fact that they all line up at the same time means that, yes, all of this is done just for us. So somebody out there must really care for us at a very high level. Otherwise, how do you explain the fact that these narrow, independent windows of time all line up at the same time?
Can you explain those in your why the universe is the way it is?
I'll explain quite a few of them in why the universe. So yeah, if you can't wait 2 weeks, you can go over there and get the book. And you'll actually hear more than what I'm going to get here in class. So, but yeah, we're going to start off with things like looking at the abundance of uranium and thorium. And this is what it looks like over the history of the universe. And what's that blue line? That blue line marks the time when the Earth formed. So you can see the Earth formed at the very peak of uranium and thorium abundance in the universe. And I'll talk why you need all that uranium and thorium. Something else you can thank God for Thanksgiving is the fact that we live on a planet that has got thousands of times more uranium and thorium than what we would otherwise expect from the laws of physics. So, yes. One quick minute, close.
Okay. Will we ever reach a point where the theory of everything, isn't that what Einstein was looking for, the theory of everything, just to kind of explain everything? Do you think we'll ever reach that, or we actually even reach the point where we understand who and what God is and what everything is all about before that decline?
It depends how you define the theory of everything. Some physicists define the theory of everything as an understanding of how all the forces of physics work together and how they separate out. I would argue that we're never going to have that complete theory. But there are people like Stephen Hawking who define the theory of everything as where we human beings would know as much as God knows about the physics of the universe, ourselves, free will, the decisions we'll make a year from now. And that's putting human beings at a level with God. And so the Bible is clear that will never happen. It won't happen
in the afterlife?
No, not there
not
either.
Not even there?
No. No.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So you're going to have to go to school in the new creation just like you will here too. There's always going to be more to learn, and you'll never know everything.
There is a school in the afterlife?
Oh, yeah. Only it's going to be fun.
are you going to be there?
Well, my wife puts it this way. You know, in this creation, when we go to school or college, we get subjected to all this stress. And I'll tell you this, I still have post-traumatic stress symptoms from exams I had to take 40 years ago. As I talked to the PhDs at Reasons to Believe, they said, yeah, we do. You know, Dave Rostad is in his 70s, and I still have these terrifying nightmares of not having studied adequately for a test. Well, in the new creation, you'll be studying, you'll be learning, but without post-traumatic stress symptoms. So, something to look forward to.
Unlike we are here.
Well, some of you get pretty stressed out here, too. So. I get pretty stressed out here. Anyway, let's bow. Father in heaven, we want to thank you for the time in which we live, the privilege, Lord, of living on the cusp of this enormous information explosion that's going on. And Father, it's exciting, at the same time it is stressful. And Lord, I pray that you would help us to see the apologetic insights and all this new data we're getting from the record of nature. May it give us greater insight in what you're trying to teach us through both the record of nature and the book of Scripture. And Father, I pray you would give us the humility to submit to you and to receive truth and life and love from you in greater measures than we ever have before. Bless each one of us with that gift, I pray. In Jesus' name, amen.